This episode is brought to you by Vertera Dinnerware. Learn more at vertera.com. That's V-E-R-T-E-R-R-A.com.
This week's Meet & Three is all about food branding and identity in 2020. The good, the bad, and the ugly.
Everybody has some Goya product in their pantry. So obviously the biggest kind of loss from all of this is the students really working with a brand that they're very comfortable with, that they're very familiar with.
I'll be honest, I was completely floored. I was very surprised that a company, especially in the current climate, would backtrack out of a commitment to address issues of racism.
Tune in to Meet & Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to The Line. I'm your host, Eli Sussman. On today's show, I welcome Lucas Sin, Eater Young Guns Class of 2019 and Forbes 30 Under 30, and the chef partner in Jinza Kitchen. Lucas opened his first restaurant when he was 16 in an abandoned newspaper factory in his hometown of Hong Kong with the help of friends and support of his family. While obtaining a degree in the cognitive science and English departments at Yale, he also hosted a pop-up out of his dorm room and cooked at multiple restaurants in New Haven. In the Yale Entrepreneurial Institute, he met his future Jinza Kitchen business partners, and there they incubated the concept. In 2015, Jinza Kitchen opened in New Haven and now has three additional locations in New York City. The company also has a new concept called Nice Day, which was born out of the pandemic and is focused on honoring classic American Chinese dishes. Nice Day is currently incubating inside of a Jinza location, while they plan to launch its own brick-and-mortar location soon. In this episode, we talk about pop-ups, not knowing what goes into opening a restaurant, the rapid growth of Jinza Kitchen as a brand, and the past, present, and future of American Chinese food.
Lucas, good morning.
Good morning, Eli.
Where are you at right now?
I'm in my apartment. I live in Manhattan, a couple blocks away from one of my restaurants on Bleecker Street.
And you are, of course, the chef of Jinza. Mm-hmm. And tell me a little bit about the spots. Are there four right now? Are all four operating during COVID?
There are four and a half, basically. The mm-hmm. half is a ghost kitchen, so it's delivery only. We have three brick-and-mortar locations here in New York City and one in New Haven, Connecticut. All of them are operational.
Did it start in New Haven? Why the New Haven location in addition to the three Manhattan locations, the three New York locations?
Yeah, New Haven was our first baby. It was our first restaurant. And we opened there because the founding group of us met in New Haven. Most of us went to Yale. The co-founders were in forestry school and in the art school doing the graduate programs. And I was doing my undergrad. And we had met on campus and got to talking and thinking about this idea and decided to go for it and built our first location in New Haven, like a block away from campus.
And none of you were in business school, right? So you were all doing other, either graduate or undergraduate.
Irrelevant things.
Things, getting degrees, which may have been applicable upon graduation, but not necessarily directly correlated to opening up a sort of a upscale fast casual restaurant.
Right. I suppose more of, you know, more of, Jinza was built more on need for us to tell a story and help evolve and write this narrative of Chinese immigrants in the U.S. Than it was. It was more sort of spurred on by this need to tell a Chinese immigration story and a more involved story about Chinese food than it was sort of like a professional drive. I can speak for myself at the very least. I've always been very, very interested in food. I was just so lucky to go to a school where I was able to engage with ideas in food while also pursuing a degree in cognitive science. I wrote my senior thesis on time travel, on mental time travel. I spent a lot of time translating modern Chinese poetry, took a lot of Japanese, nothing to do with what I'm doing today. But during all of this, I was running pop-ups out of my dorm room. And I think that was how I really got entrenched in this culinary world, sort of like earlier on.
So you became kind of enamored with the idea of what a restaurant could be based on how it was operating in your dorm room as a pop-up?
Right. Sort of, yeah. I think it might be worth dialing back a little, actually back to secondary school, to high school. So I'm from Hong Kong. I grew up there, and I was 16 years old when we opened our first little restaurant in the abandoned newspaper factory. And so this is a newspaper factory that was sort of like repurposed after the newspaper moved. And it had all these little sort of like cells or units inside. And people would snap up these units and repurpose them for whatever they were using it for. And so we knew somebody who had a wine cellar that was attached to basically a semi-professional kitchen. And we went in there and we said, can we use a space? Let's start running a restaurant or a private kitchen, as we used to call it, a private kitchen out of here. And we would serve 13 courses of Hong Kong-inspired cuisine, me and my friends. I'd teach people how to hold three plates at once and pretend like you know what you're talking about when you're talking about wine, and come up with new menus every day and stuff. And we'd do this for our summers. And that was, sooner or later, it kind of, well, put it this way, it was at the end of the day, it was us taking ourselves way too seriously and playing restaurant as children. But that sort of sentiment continued as we were in college. And I joined up with a couple of new friends, and we kept doing a similar type of thing in school. So as a result, I think my early years, sort of my first foray into the culinary world, would have been through this world of pop-ups.
This Hong Kong pop-up that you did when you started it when you were 16, did you sell tickets? Who was coming? Friends, family? Did it gain any publicity or traction? Were like regular people making reservations?
Yeah. First of all, it was entirely illegal. second of all,
that makes it that much more enticing.
I know. It was so cool because, like, well, we just, the conversation went at, like, I was in the car with my dad, and he's like, hey, you got a couple summers left before you go off to school. Most likely you're going to go to school in the US or the UK or Australia or whatever. What are you going to do with the rest of your summers here in Hong Kong? And we're just talking, and he said, do you like food, don't you? And I said, yeah, I think I like food. And so, why don't you just open a restaurant? And I said, what are you talking about? And you just start to, you start to like hack it together, right? You bootstrap, you sandbag, you do whatever. You're like, you're 16. So you're like, hey, I think we need bowls. So you go to the street in Hong Kong that sells bowls and you buy bowls. You're like, hey, I need to develop a menu. So you just start going to night markets. You start, like, we traveled a little and like, we just like ask people, how do you cook this? You know, just watch people cook all day. Just like start learning it little by little. Watched a lot of Jamie Oliver. Just consume as much as information as you can and just like start faking it, you know? The people who were coming were all kind of coming by word of mouth. It was like our teachers, our parents, other like friends of friends and stuff. And it was pretty cool. We set up this little shuttle system, and people would get picked up at a random location, and they'd be shuttled off to this sort of like secret newspaper factory where we would lead them up into this room, and then they'd sit inside a wine cellar, and then we would serve them these like 13 courses. And I guess what was kind of like weird about these private kitchens, because, well, private kitchens were quite common in Hong Kong. You can imagine high rents. So a lot of really creative chefs want to cook in basically apartments without these, without licenses or anything, in order to stay creative, but also keep that rent low. And so what was interesting about this sort of like creative space in all these different types of private kitchens in Hong Kong, including our own, was that a lot of the time was really sort of like narrative driven. Like the chef would come to your table and tell you, hey, this is what I was thinking when I was putting this together. Here's the inspiration. And I think that type of like engagement with the customer and saying that, hey, this food is more than what's delicious. It also tells a story. I think it was really, really important to how I came around to thinking about food.
it's such a difficult business, as we both know now that we're truly doing it professionally as adults. But as a 16-year-old, especially when you're saying that you don't know anything and that you really were just kind of figuring out as you go, there could have been a wide variety of entrepreneurial business opportunities that you could have taken over the summer. You could have started a clothing brand. You could have interned at another real company. So why the restaurant? Like, if you were just kind of just vaguely into food, how in the world did you say to yourself, let me do what is essentially the hardest business to start? And then you did it with your friends as a 16-year-old.
Yeah, I mean, a couple things. First thing is that we didn't know how hard it was going to be. Second of all, I think I was probably underselling the fact that I was a little into food. I was obsessed with food. My whole family was. I feel like most people in Hong Kong are. Usually when I, you know, do interviews like this, people want me to say is that my grandmother was a cook, and she was a cook, but she hated it. And she made it clear to me that I should not become a cook when I grew up. But she was, you know, cooking the mahjong parlor. She did have an affinity for food, right? We ate 3 times a day. My dad is honestly, in my opinion, the best home cook of all time. He could always make food out of nothing. And, you know, we would spend a lot of our weekends sort of like prowling Hong Kong and traveling and trying to look for new flavors and that sort of thing. And I think what my parents had sort of like indoctrinated me early on is that if you eat 3 times a day, why not think about the food that you're eating, like in a deep way? How is it made? Where does it come from? Why do I like something? Why don't I like something? What's the difference between the bowl of noodles at this restaurant instead of the other restaurant? And just like being a little bit more curious about the food, I think developed that's how the sort of like interest in food grew. But what really hooked me was kitchen culture, I think. I was really excited to be a part of a restaurant where everyone was just working so hard, where diligence and hard work really paid off, where there was creativity, but there was also camaraderie. I tried to spend every summer and every winter I did basically working in kitchens. I was on call for a lot of like restaurants in New Haven, and you know, chefs would text me in English class when I was in university and say, hey, I need you to come work service today after class. And I was like, yeah, I'll come and just help out, or I'll wash the dishes. I started cooking in Hong Kong over a couple of summers just to get a little bit more professional experience so that I could go into other kitchens, and then started working for some of these private kitchens that I mentioned earlier. Eventually, I had started cooking through Japan. My first summer was spent learning the Japanese language in Japan and cooking with Japanese grandmothers to learn home cooking. I spent another summer backpacking through Japan, just cooking at izakayas, which are kind of like gastropub kind of bars with little like snacks type of thing, junk food. And then I spent my another summer cooking at Kikunoi Honten, which is a 3-star Michelin World's 50 Best kaiseki place in Kyoto. That was really, really quite intense. But kind of just spending every weekend, every summer, every chance I got in a professional kitchen, and like loving every moment of it, just because it's such a unique like assembly of people. You know, it's so cool when everyone's in sync and the restaurant works and everyone's doing what they're supposed to be doing. I just really enjoyed that culture, and I think that's what kind of convinced me that cooking was what I wanted to do probably for the rest of my life.
Was there an expectation either from your parents or from yourself that you would, no matter what you planned on doing in the culinary world, that you would go to a university and complete schooling? Or were you kind of hedging your bets that the food thing might not work out, so you still went to a 4-year university?
I think I was, both my parents and myself were motivated to put me through school. I don't know if that's how I put it, but both my mom and my dad and myself were very excited that I was going to school for the full 4 years. I, on top of this, perhaps by the way I speak, you can already tell I'm a massive nerd. I loved school. I've always loved school, and had a lot of interest that I wanted to investigate. So going to a liberal arts 4-year college where I had the privilege of being able to read and learn things that I normally wouldn't, I think was a given. And I certainly was going to go through university. It almost feels like the university thing may or may not have worked out, which is why I'm in food now.
Why do you say that it didn't work out?
I mean, I'm not a cognitive scientist. I don't work for a publishing firm. I don't work for a bank. I'm not in a management consultancy. All those things that all of my friends in college are doing right now. So I suppose that's sort of what I'm.
You had earlier said that there was sort of an expectation from your father that you were going to go to school in either the UK or Australia or the United States. You didn't say that you would maybe stay in Hong Kong. So was the plan always that you would leave Hong Kong and travel overseas and make a life somewhere else? Or was that more based on where you chose college and then you stayed?
I think so. Actually, you're right. It was based on where I was going to school. But the school I went to was an international school in Hong Kong. So most of us, and by most, probably about 80 to 90% of us, ended up going to school abroad, either in the US or the UK.
And so you come to New Haven. Had you spent a lot of time, any time in the United States prior to moving to New Haven?
I think I'd done like one or two summer programs, maybe. In high schools and stuff, but actually, you know what? I've totally forgotten this. I lived in California for a while. I was born in Canada, and then I think when I was 3 or 4, moved to California for a year or two before going back to Hong Kong.
So you wouldn't have remembered it, really. But
I remember some of it. I remember school lunch. I remember eating pizza out of styrofoam boxes. And very little else. Perhaps when I was 3 or 4, I developed an immense love for Chinese American food, which I still love today. But yeah, otherwise, I don't really remember it now.
Can we talk a little bit about the distinction between Chinese American food and what the opposite of that would be, if that is like Hong Kong street food, or if you could just clarify a little bit, if I'm totally way off base, what are some of the main differentials that either people get confused about or just don't understand?
So most Americans know Chinese food as General Tso's chicken and sesame chicken, lo mein, like dishes like that, right? That's probably the Chinese food most people this generation grew up eating. And that Chinese American food, in my opinion, is a regional type of Chinese cuisine. When people say Chinese food to me, it's kind of like when people say European food. There are 50-something provinces, 20-something ethnic minorities, at least 4,000 years of culinary history, a huge amount of documentation and courts and aristocrats and rich people like throughout a lot of this time, which is to say that cuisine really, really developed, right? The history of Chinese cuisine is massive. And on one hand, yes, it is a little disappointing that most Americans unfortunately only know about this one regional Chinese cuisine, this one Chinese American cuisine, when there's so much else out there. But a lot of people who are engaged or know about this conversation, unfortunately, and to me even more disappointingly, tend to characterize Chinese food in America, American Chinese food, as inauthentic. You know, it's not real, which to me is absolutely ridiculous, because it absolutely is real. There are 46,000 Chinese something like 46,000 Chinese restaurants in the U.S. before COVID, at the very least. And all of them are staffed by people with families, many of which came to this country to build these Chinese American restaurants. If they've built this huge, massive network within the diaspora that's bigger than Burger King's, McDonald's, and KFC's combined, then you can only imagine sort of how real this cuisine is. And so I think I'm really interested in honoring that sort of American Chinese food as a predecessor to a lot of other regional types of Chinese food that have started to trickle into the U.S., like Sichuanese cuisine, Hunanese cuisine, renewals of Cantonese cooking and stuff. But that's really important to like sort of understand this like historical context, right? The great news is that the type of people who come to the U.S. from China are slightly different than they were before, which is to say that it's a little bit more diverse. There are more people coming from places that aren't just Hong Kong and southern China, which means that they bring other styles of cuisine with them, such as, you know, this massive craze in places like California and New York for spicy Sichuan cooking. There's more like Yunnanese cooking that's coming up, Hunanese cooking. People are exploring the relationships between Chinese Korean food or Chinese Japanese food, and there are these like cool cultural crossovers. So the landscape, the dining landscape for Chinese cuisine is getting more and more colorful, which is great as well. At Junzi, we, because it is a fast casual and accessibility is important, we sort of focus on home-style Chinese cooking, which for a lot of the time is kind of vegetable-forward, relatively light. You can have it every day type of things. We also actually just launched a new sister brand called Nice Day Chinese, which is an investigation into the American Chinese side of things, but we can talk about that a little later.
Yeah, definitely. I do want to also ask just a follow-up about the menu, which is that, so you've highlighted that there are so many provinces, there's so many different styles and varieties of cuisine that just kind of blanket calling them Chinese food maybe doesn't do justice to all the amazing varieties. So I'm wondering, from a menu conceptualization standpoint, is it exciting? Is it daunting to have all of this access to all of these potential recipes and flavors and dishes when you're trying to distill that down into a fast casual menu?
What an awesome question. And I love that I get to talk with chefs about this and then talk to you about this because it's a very chefy question, right? You have so much available to you. Like, what do you choose to use? I think a lot of the times, well, I think in the fast casual world and in this sort of like fast casual or quick service, the customer is really quite important and oftentimes more important than the chef. And so in this case, we need to make food that people can connect with and are able to understand. That absolutely doesn't mean we need to pander to either the chef's creative drives or pander to the customers, what people might think of customers kind of more basic, unsophisticated wants. It's about understanding what a customer wants and seeing how that can be, how the Chinese food that we have in front of us can be translated. Now, the type of cuisine we settled for is the type of food that almost is ubiquitous despite which region of China you might be in. This is the tomato and egg stir fry. This is, you know, the cured cucumbers, the lion's head meatballs, beef and peppers and type of thing. The way perhaps, I'm trying to think of a good analogy here, but perhaps the way we think, we don't really think of hamburgers as German anymore. They're just somehow American, perhaps is a good analogy. But there are certain dishes that just everyone in China makes no matter what region you're in. And so those dishes, I think, first of all, over history, have proved that they are, that people enjoy them. And second of all, it's a lower barrier of entry for people to understand. If people came up to us and we said, hey, we have this highly regional Yunnanese type of mushroom dumpling that is also served with yogurt or whatever, people would say, hey, wait a minute. There's a lot of steps to understand before I can order this dish. Whereas in fast casual, you don't have that luxury. So you want to keep things a little bit more simple. So simplicity of understanding is really important. At Junzi, we like to think of this idea as a certain bandwidth of communication, which is to say some people have, when people come into a restaurant, they have a certain amount of information that they can process, right? Depending on how much time they're inside of a restaurant. We don't want to overload them with too much stuff. We want to communicate it's in fast casual, you have maybe between 1 and 5 minutes of your customer's time. So in that time, you want to get to them and you want them to tell you what they want to eat, but you also want to make sure that they're not overloaded or stressed out or overburdened by the amount of information you're giving them. So in this case, we have to kind of like hold back on some of that narrative and storytelling about what specific regions we're cooking from.
Often when a business is born out of, in someone's mind, it can be born out of either a need to fill a void, or it can be born out of a desire to create that business. And when those overlap, that's a wonderful thing. I'm wondering, when you were in New Haven and you were speaking with your friends and later your partners, did you think to yourself, this needs to be here? Or did you think, I really want this to be here? Or was it both?
I think it starts with a want and then it develops into a need. So to be clear, my co-founders, Yang and Wanting, had been thinking about this since, I believe it was like 2013 or 2014, while they were still in school. And it was a want in the beginning. They had wanted food to eat on a regular basis that reflected who they were and their desires, right? Like in particular, it was noodles and bings. So bings are these sort of like flat, they're basically unyeasted flat rolls, right? But also it's a generic term for anything that's basically circular or round. So in China, you would call pizza a pizza bing. Scallion pancakes are scallion bing, for example. But anyway, it was this craving for northern Chinese bings and for noodles that were tossed in sauce instead of served in soup. That's kind of the craving that they had in the beginning. And that's almost certainly a want. But the more you talk about it, the more you talk about operationalizing this business, the more you talk about developing this business into a brand, you realize that it actually really is a need. That we've identified that in the US, there is a need for new life in the Chinese food sort of space, so to speak. And so we developed Junzi into almost more of a startup company than it is really just a series of restaurants. It's a startup company that addresses specifically this issue, this need that we think Americans have for a more sort of like diverse and inclusive and colorful understanding of what Chinese food should be and can be. And so that's why we have so many sort of like different projects going on at Junzi beyond the fast casual. The fast casual is kind of the bedrock, is kind of the foundation. And then on top of that, there's distance dining there, which is kind of like a delivered three-course tasting kind of narrative type of chef experience. There's Instagram Live. There's Nice Day Chinese for Chinese American Chinese food. And it's so on and so forth. And we've been dabbling in all these different types of projects, different corners of the food industry to see how they can address this core need of, you know, how do we further Chinese food in the US?
Do you see all of those different segments of the business as standalone entities that perhaps one of them grows and really extends far beyond the other aspects of the business? Do you see them all growing in tandem? Are they symbiotic and require each other to exist?
Yeah. I certainly think of them as growing in tandem and symbiotic. They need each other. And oftentimes, if you look at your sheets, right, certain brands might bring in a lot more revenue than other brands. Certain businesses may do a lot better than others. But that doesn't mean that they're not working together. An analogy is building Chinese food in the US is kind of like building a house, right? You need a foundation, you need a roof, and then you need everything else in between. The roof is kind of, the foundation might be fast casual. You know, on Monday, you might have Sweetgreen. On Tuesday, you might have Chipotle. On Wednesday, it would be good to have Junzi, to have Chinese fast casual. Why not? The upper limit is when people who are sort of like dedicated to investigating more about Chinese food, right? Foodies, for example, people who are interested in food history might say, I'd really like some more communication with the chef, and I want to see creative cooking in interesting contexts. And then that might be distance dining or chef study or whatnot. In between, in the future, I can imagine that we would want to move into areas like agriculture and say that, hey, we need to be growing our own vegetables in order to really further what people think about Chinese food. For example, right? Speaking very sort of ambitiously, but I think all of these things must grow in concert with each other so that we have multiple touch points for potential new customers and for returning customers, but also we can grow a little bit of an ecosystem where people can come to us as a growing authority on Chinese cooking.
I definitely want to talk about distance dining, and so we will get there, but I want to jump back a little bit to New Haven. You and a couple of your friends have this idea. You're still going to school full time, and it seems like you're also cooking full time whenever these guys call you and say, pick up a shift here and there.
Yeah.
So you've made yourself even busier than you could have already possibly been while trying to finish up school and get in that Ivy League location, that education finished up. So when you're looking for a location, do you go out and try to fundraise? Did you go to your family? Did you go to other students? How did that process unfold of opening up a location in New Haven?
I wasn't the person sort of in charge of fundraising. The fundraising master and the sort of financials guy is Yang, our CEO. And in the early stages, we structured ourselves very much like a startup. And by that, I meant we went through a program that was then called the Yale Entrepreneurial Institute, where mentors, business mentors, would coach you through how to build a startup. And that, honestly, for a couple of months is about writing a business model and pitching to people. And I think in a very short amount of time, Yang and Wan Ting and the other co-founders that came before I joined the team really worked hard to learn how to do those things. So they pitched everyone from their parents to people that our business mentors know and friends of friends and whatnot. And I think mustered enough money to build our first restaurant in New Haven, which upon reflection was a lot cheaper than if we were to open a first restaurant in New York. The good news is that New Haven still to this day is one of my favorite cities that I've ever cooked in. It's immensely collaborative. It is, my opinion, one of those like perfect small cities. The food scene is incredible. The pizza obviously is the best in the world. And everyone just like knows everybody and it's a very supportive community. On top of the fact that, this is a business that was built sort of through Yale. We both have a Yale connection and a city connection, which I think was important to us early on. On the other hand, I think a sort of wise decision for us, because at the end of the day, I was 21 years old when we, or 22 years old when we opened the first Junzi. None of us really had enough restaurant experience, or even experience in the food industry at large. So kind of trialing it and opening a first location in New Haven allowed us to practice restaurant until we moved to move down to New York and open our first location by Columbia a year later.
We're going to take a quick break. Stick with us.
This episode is brought to you by Vertera, impressively versatile, stylishly sustainable, environmentally disposable dinnerware from fallen leaves. Vertera is a mission-driven company focused on making environmentally responsible, single-use products. Founded in 2006 on the belief that every culinary creation deserves a beautiful, sustainably crafted foundation, Vertera reclaims earthly discards like fallen leaves and tree scraps to design elegant, disposable dinnerware that elevates the look of food presentation. In short, a beautiful disposable plate that can go with your food to a composting facility. The team from Vertera recently made a huge pivot with their factories and started producing masks, gloves, sanitizer, and other PPE that food businesses need to safely reopen. Learn more at Vertera.com. That's Vertera.com.
Welcome back to The Line here on Heritage Radio. I'm your host, Eli Sussman. On today's show, Lucas Sin, chef and partner in Junza Kitchen, which began in the Yale Entrepreneurial Institute and opened its first location in New Haven, Connecticut in 2015. It has since grown to a multi-unit brand with three additional locations open in New York City. Here's the second half of the interview.
What kind of missteps and issues did you run into at first once you got open and customers were coming through the doors? What unintended problems occurred from being such young guys starting up a business and maybe not having the adequate background and experience in the real world that you may need to open up a fast casual restaurant?
I mean, every problem imaginable, right? Like, the crazy thing about being a chef of a restaurant is for some reason you also need to know how to plumb. You need to know how to do HR. You need to know how to account. You need to know how to clean the grease trap. It's just like every
corner, totally unfair, right? Yeah, why did we have to become good at everything simultaneously?
And yeah, and on top of that, the crazy thing about the food system, and I think about, you know, the name of the podcast is The Line, is like you start working at The Line, and then through maybe, I don't know, between the ages of 16 and 30, if you're just working like through a regular progression, you just learn how to become a really good cook and you make really good food. But suddenly overnight, you get promoted to become the executive chef of a restaurant. And then you have to manage people. You have to manage workplace culture. You have to order. You have to like write menus. None of this stuff of which you had any training in, right, up until that point, basically. And so just jumping there as the first starting point was crazy. And learning all these little things here and there, I think were really important. And as you know, I think the rule, generally speaking, is that when you triple the amount of business you bring in, you have to redo all of your operations. So in the early days, every other day, you are redoing your operations. You're re-understanding your procedures. You are configurating your equipment. You're learning how to put together these more scalable training programs, for example, scaling up your recipes and that sort of thing, just step by step. I think I would say we've made mistakes every corner, and we still do every day, but we've learned really quickly from them. And we have a very supportive network to sort of show us which direction to move in. At this point, Junza has less than, I think it's probably around 15 employees in our support center. So our support center is what some people might call their headquarters. And we've sort of like made specific departments really quite important early on, which is unusual for a restaurant of our size. Business intelligence, for example, we do a lot of data analytics to understand how our products are performing, how our customers are responding, and also like which potential markets we might want to move in. A lot of our decisions to be informed by quantitative, but by data. So that's important to us. Branding and design is all done at Junza in-house, because we know how important it is to create a cohesive brand, even if you have so many different projects going at the same time. So our graphic designers to our architects are all in-house as well, not to mention HR, accounting and operations and supply chain management. So all of these sort of like aspects, I think, are really important to the company. And it's important to keep that close to ourselves because we are aiming to be innovative. So we want to do a lot of that stuff ourselves.
It's amazing what you just touched on, because that really, there's going to be people listening that say that's the dream. You have the ability to have these top level conversations with everyone who's super invested in the brand, because each one of your leadership, each part of your leadership is all in the same place, and you all are executing with the common goal of doing the best for the business. And it doesn't have to be, you know, outsourced to five different companies that then have to try to work harmoniously, which mm-hmm. is extremely difficult. But the flip side of what you've just touched on is that you have large infrastructure, which is pretty expensive. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering about how that affects the overall growth of the company. Did you make the conscious decision at the beginning to have this really solid infrastructure and then have to raise additional money for it? Or does this just come out of the existing revenue stream of the locations?
As a startup, you absolutely have a high burn rate that you need to sustain by looking for investment. I think the it's kind of like a cycle of looking for investment and then putting that investment to good use to increase your revenue streams and diversify your revenue streams and start new projects, for example. And then after a while, look for more investment again. We decided to structure Jones more like almost like a tech startup, right? Or rather more like a startup than a restaurant, because we're learning from a lot of companies like Sweetgreen, Digin, for example, that were structuring it similarly, because growth necessitates the mission, or rather, no, I'll put it the other way. The mission necessitates growth, right? If you want to change what people think about Chinese food, people need to eat Chinese food. And if you want more people to eat Chinese food, you need more stores. You need more sort of places for customers to purchase that food. And so for all these reasons, you need a lot of investment. And right now, Junzi is pre-Series A, so we haven't actually officially went into our Series A yet. So far, it's all angel investors and family and friends, so to speak. As we sort of, as COVID starts to clear up and we have a better sense of what our outlook is for the next couple of years, I think that's when we'll start moving to Series A and looking at more rapid expansion.
Did you make the decision to open in New York because New Haven was doing exceptionally well and performing at a level at which you thought you could compete in the world's most difficult restaurant market? Or were those decisions independent? Did you say New Haven's New Haven and we should give New York a shot and see if this will work in New York?
I think New York was always the dream because we knew the type of impact we wanted to make. And we knew that we wanted people to hear this story and eat this food. So we opened New Haven with the explicit notion that we're going to get things right here so that we can move into New York. The New Haven location, however, consistently surprises me to this day. It's the same. We've had the same manager there for 5 years. That restaurant in New Haven has the lowest turnover rate of all I've ever heard of. I believe last time I checked, the industry standard is something around 17% year over year of turnover of staff, which is to say 17% of staff remain in the fast casual world. That's a number that I think we saw like a year or two ago. But New Haven for the longest time was posting 70%, as in with its teams less than 10 people or around 10 people, like one or two would leave every year. And it's like a little family over there. The food is, in my opinion, still great. It's an 800 square feet store, but they're still putting out food on a consistent basis. They were feeding hundreds, if not thousands, of essential workers during COVID. And I'm always really proud of that store. And me and my team go and visit there as frequently as we can. But New Haven does hold a very dear place to my heart. Speaking of New Haven, actually, collaborations are so important to me as a chef to like get new ideas and whatnot. So in New Haven, we were doing collaborations like almost once a week, once every 2 weeks. And by collaborations, I meant people come up to me, like bump into me at a bar or something and say, "Hey, Lucas, do you like hot dogs?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I love hot dogs." And he's like, "You should do a hot dog restaurant at your little Chinese restaurant." And I'm like, "Yeah, down, let's do it." Or, "Hey, let's do a popcorn pop-up or a fried chicken pop-up. Hey, what if we just did like Mexican Chinese food?" And like just these like silly ideas would float around. And then I think distance dining, chef study, all these other projects like really stem from this early thinking that, hey, we should just try things, like do whatever and use it as a neighborhood community pop-up space. And I think New Haven was very much like that. When I was still living in New Haven with the team and, the chief of operations, the head of operations is the actual manager of the store. We were just doing silly events like that all the time. But it was so cool. And I really miss that type of community that was slowly trying to build here in New York. But everything moves a little bit quicker in New York, and so there is less time to play with events like that. But anyway, I obviously miss it a lot.
Although it does seem that you do have four stores, so you are a pretty good sized company, but you do also seem nimble and small and fun, and you can do all these unique events and kind of integrations that you come up with an idea and you can put them into effect pretty quickly. And I think that's sort of a testament to maybe having everyone in-house at the same time, that you can come up with an idea and you can implement it pretty quickly. Is there any worry that some of that personal identity that makes Junza special, that as you continue to grow and you have to standardize more procedures and you start digging in harder and harder to that data and those analytics, that you will not be able to keep some of that personality within the brand?
Yeah, that's a great question. How do you grow a personality? I think the way we kind of like keep it, the approach so far has been to like carefully and intelligently segment, right, that into the different arms of our business. I think distance dining, for example, gives us an opportunity to tell a story in a very deep way that we can't do at the fast casual at Junza Kitchen. I think Eat Nice Day or Nice Day Chinese, which is our new Chinese-American concept that we're playing around with right now, or American-Chinese concept we're playing around with right now, is even less of a narrative communication when people get through the door. It's about carefully segmenting when and where you want to display your personality and to engage your guests and the rest of the community in conversation. There's time for it, and there's also time to not do that. So I think and I'm lucky that I can be cook at a restaurant group of this size and still be able to actually put food together that my customers can eat, right? That I still have a chance to come up with new menus on a regular basis and engage with chefs I want to engage with and learn about cuisine, which is which I count myself very, very fortunate for, because you can imagine that a lot of, you know, culinary directors or chefs at fast casual restaurants don't get to do that anymore. And a lot of other chefs that I know kind of in this field talk about how they aren't able to express themselves creatively anymore. It's kind of a bummer. So I'm very lucky to be able to do all of that.
Is Nice Day a sort of a standalone concept that will one day have its own brick and mortar?
Yeah, so right now it's running as a pop-up at our Bleecker location on Wednesdays mm-hmm. to Sundays. And we're playing around with the concept because the number of Chinese restaurants in the U.S. have dwindled, and that's even before COVID. That's, we were tracking over the last 2 years, I believe, 16% of Chinese restaurants had closed in the New York area. 16%. That's out of nowhere. That's before any anti-Chinese sentiment. That's before any racism, before COVID's putting old businesses out of place. What that number looks like right now, I don't know for sure, but I imagine it's way worse. And the reason why these restaurants are closing, well, on one hand, it's a good thing, right? Chinese immigrants come to the U.S. They open a restaurant. It's really hard work. The kids become doctors and lawyers, and so they don't have to run restaurants anymore. So obviously your chicken and broccoli place is going to close. That's kind mm-hmm. of a good thing.
They but don't want to do what their parents
did. They don't want to do it. Yeah, because it sucks, right? It's like really hard work.
And their parents don't want them to do it either, right? Exactly. That's kind of was the whole point.
Yeah. And on top of that, the cooks that work at this restaurant, they were coming here because they didn't speak any English and they didn't know how to do anything. They didn't have any skills that would be helpful if you don't speak English. So they end up in restaurants, right? Hey, I have a cousin. He's coming over from Fujian. Can he work at your Cantonese place, right? That's kind of the idea. Now, the people that come to the U.S. aren't coming to cook. They're coming to go to elite universities, right? They're opening cool restaurants of their own. There are not a lot of cooks coming here because the economic opportunity in China is massive. So they'd rather be cooking over there. So this sort of like confluence of reasons causes Chinese-American food or American-Chinese food to be on a little bit of a decline. But what I was saying earlier, and like hearkening back to what I was saying earlier, I'm kind of like excited about preserving that heritage or saying something or doing something about it. I think it's important to preserve that, these like American Chinese sort of like traditions, but also to continue the conversation and like help evolve it as a new Chinese immigrant. I don't believe in elevating American Chinese food. I don't believe in like, hey, fancy chef comes in and, you know, changes things up and makes it his own. I'm more invested in trying to address the structural and supply side weaknesses of American Chinese food in the U.S., which, as mentioned, are like an aging population of people who work and staff and own these restaurants. It has a very sort of small, insular supply chain, which is pretty resistant to change. And its demographic but despite all these challenges, the demographic of their customers is constantly growing. Chinese American food is the second most delivered food in the U.S. after pizza. Like, there's a huge market here. But if restaurants are closing, I think smart people can do something about it.
Is there any brands that exist in the United States right now that if you were to be comparing Jinza to them, it would either be a compliment or would it make you cringe? I could name some, but I'm curious.
Yeah, go for it.
I will just shout out and say Panda Express.
Love Panda Express. I love Panda Express.
And so is that a business that you look to and say they've done an excellent job as a business and or from a culinary standpoint, and that is someone that we look
to learn from, as a
model, or perhaps someone who's come before that we can do the job better than them?
Absolutely. In a lot of ways, yes. I can't speak entirely to the business model because I think that would take too long, but I can tell you a story about a culinary side of things. Have you been to Panda Express, right?
I have many times.
Right? Have you had honey walnut shrimp?
I have.
It's an amazing dish. Like, when it's good, it's really, really, really good, in my opinion. And the best I've ever had it was in, like, Terminal 2 of JFK or whatever. And this honey walnut shrimp, right? So I eat this honey walnut shrimp on a flight, before a flight to China. And I go to China. I'm going to northern China, to northeastern China, to Liaoning, to cook in a fancy restaurant for a month. And as I'm cooking there, it's like one of my last days there. And this guy says, hey, if you want to graduate from the proverbial cooking school, this is one of the test dishes. And he takes a really sort of beautiful prawn and he butterflies it. And then he stamps it out until it's really quite thin. He breads it and then he deep fries it sort of lightly until it's like golden brown, like a little lighter than usual, like almost a little fluffy, right? And then in the wok, he adds a bit of just granulated white sugar and a little bit of water and starts making a syrup. And he's basically sort of making it just before it becomes a caramel, before it starts turning brown, he tosses those fried shrimps inside of this wok. Now, you know, woks go up to 1,000-something degrees. They're super, super ridiculously hot. So they're notoriously difficult to control the temperature of. So, and you're trying to make a sugar, so you're actually cooking at a relatively low temperature. But what he's doing is he's tossing the fried shrimps in sugar, in the thinnest, like, crystal layer of sugar. He pulls the shrimp out, and he just lets it cool for a couple of seconds so that the sugar can harden, which happens in a matter of, like, 5 to 10 seconds. What you end up having is a fried shrimp that is eternally crispy, like, forever, because of this sugar, sort of like this sugar crust that's on outside of the fried battered shrimp. Now, this is a technique dish, which is to say it's an imperial dish. It's a dish that chefs in courts would have been cooking back in the day to impress emperors and politicians and whatnot. And Panda Express looked at this dish and said, let's serve this at 2,000 locations. And they did it within like a year or a year and a half or something. And that's insane. Right, that they capture, like, obviously it's not like that all the time, right? This hot honey walnut shrimp isn't exactly like this fine dining fancy version. But they looked at something like that and said, "Hey, let's scale this up," and they absolutely are able to scale it up. So that, in my opinion, I've had it so many times, I'm going to say 95% of the time it's delicious. Now, Panda Express, on the other hand, some might argue it's a little outdated, and I totally agree with that, because Panda Express was built in the 80s. P.F. Chang's came shortly after in the 90s. And both of these restaurants, I think, are super, super important for the development of Chinese food in the U.S. The founder of P.F. Chang's, Philip Chang, is a dear friend of mine, and he's also a mentor and actually an investor in Jinza. And whenever we talk, we always talk about how since 1993, when P.F. Chang's was built, there hasn't really been another brand to represent Chinese food at scale. And what this new brand needs to do is demonstrate that quantity doesn't mean diminishing of quality, that you can have both, that scalability can bring around good things as well. It can make for a more efficient food system, and it can employ people in hopefully eventually like an ethical and intelligent way, and bring a huge amount of cultural change to a large amount of people. So that's kind of like, I would absolutely hope to say that one day I can really look at Jinza and say, we really followed the footsteps of Panda Express and P.F. Chang's, and we're on our way to doing something good.
A lot of what we were just talking about is actually about the kind of mind-blowing consistency that can be achieved by large-scale fast casual brands across multiple locations. And to me, that's something that always gets me so excited to think about. Like, if you eat a hamburger in South Dakota, or you eat it in Hong Kong, or you eat it in Australia, and it's a Burger King hamburger, it's going to be very, very, very similar. And that always blows my mind. And so as someone who's in the fast casual space, and you have four locations, so it is easier to control consistency, but still, I assume, challenging. How do you internally develop a dish and then roll it out so that it is consistent across your locations? And as you look to expand, how do you hope to achieve consistency across multiple locations?
First of all, the Chinese restaurants that already exist in the US have achieved this with no need for an overarching headquarters, right? Like Sesame Chicken in Arkansas, exactly the same as Sesame Chicken in Vermont.
How is that possible?
Like, there's no trading manual. There's no PDF that these guys are like passing around.
It's
like,
just so good and so satisfying and so similar. No matter what city, if you're in a city of 400 people, there's a Chinese restaurant and it tastes the same as the one in the city of 700,000 people.
Yeah, exactly. And it's amazing. And the way they did that is through a very complicated, intricate and insular network of passing ideas, recipes, and labor around, right? Like, we have a uniquely scalable system that is entirely decentralized, where, hey, I have a cousin coming over. He's going to work for you for a little bit. He's going to hate his job eventually. He's going to move to another place. And somehow, like, over the last 150, 170 years or whatever it's been, like, we have developed this Chinese food system that is in a lot of ways as impressive as any McDonald's in terms of scalability and consistency of product without that overhead. And so I say, first of all, because that's something to learn from, right? To look at these systems and really try to study and understand them and say, what can we learn from the way you guys do things? The similarities between these two restaurants on the different sides of the country, how do we learn from this operation and these procedures to achieve consistency? People have long, long shelved Chinese food away like that and just say, okay, you know, they, for whatever reason, it's exactly the same. But nobody really has gone into, like, study it. And so I think studying and paying your debts and, like, understanding that first and foremost is a huge, I've learned so much about how to standardize operations from looking at these mom and pop shops. Second of all, I have a really wonderful team that really understands the need for scalability, and we've developed a process that is very similar to design thinking. So we took a lot of pages out of like a designer's playbook, which is to say, every time we come up with a new sort of dish to put on the menu, it goes through this process of understanding a specific customer need, looking at quantitative data, getting customer profiles, understanding your target audience, and then creating a new dish that's a product and testing it over and over again in smaller circles and then bigger circles and then bigger circles, and then having like a little bit of a rollout and maintenance phase of the product. Now, all of this is kind of a jumbled way to explain that I think it's really important that more chefs and more restaurants start thinking about their dishes less as dishes or recipes, so to speak, more like products, right? That they need to be managed, that they have a certain life cycle. There are quantitative measures for how well they're doing and when to change them or when not to change them and whatnot. And I'm not advocating for every restaurant needing a business intelligence department, but what I am advocating for is for us to start thinking about these things we're putting on the menu as things we're really trying to sell, and understanding the metrics that will help us make those decisions about how to change something and whatnot. So I think relying on that sort of design thinking process, plus a lot of reference to this massive Chinese American operations as a precedent, I think is kind of how we're approaching a lot of this scalability question.
It's a complete and total different mindset from the traditional restaurant experience, from being in a Michelin kitchen where it's about a singular dish and plating it, and you're going to do it 35 times tonight and it's going to be perfect. But what we're talking about is doing it 3,500 times during the lunch rush at multiple locations with different people. Yeah.
And a lot of the time it's people who used to work at Forever 21 and Burger King. You know? it's like, how are you going to ask somebody like that to taste something and be like, this needs a touch more salt, you know, or whatever it is. And like, I think when we're talking about, and it's such a fascinating question for me, because a lot of people will say, you know what, like you are dumbing down cooking, right? You're doing a disservice to the whole culinary industry by really simplifying things. But the hope is actually that you simplify things enough so that people don't have to do this in the long term, right? That you don't have to, like, who enjoys just flipping burgers, right? Like, who really genuinely just enjoys doing that all the time? But if you can figure out a procedure to make it more efficient, then you can free up more people, right, to think creatively and do things that they genuinely do enjoy, right? Interacting with customers, like managing other staff and that sort of thing, like programming equipment, and that's kind of like the goal, I think, for fast casual. And given that, I think between COVID and the George Floyd protests and this larger kind of like food media reckoning, I would say that the restaurant industry has to take a good look at itself to see, to understand its vulnerabilities and see how, from the operations and the procedure standpoint, we can really alleviate some of these difficulties and free up how we free up the most painful parts of running a restaurant.
Yeah, for me, I think there's no greater compliment than someone saying that, oh, this recipe was so easy to execute. The recipe book that you have in the kitchen just explained it to me step by step. And, oh, these pickups are so easy, anyone could do it. It's like, yes, that is the point. We're trying to make this super standardized so that, yes, someone could step in and with a couple hours training, they could have a, you know, a job that pays them well. And hopefully where they're treated with respect, and yeah, they don't have to do it for forever, but it's a good job that they can do. I do want to talk about the current state of the world, and just in the last 6 months, as everything has just completely been upended, you're in the midst of a growing brand and you're in New York City, and we've had extensive shutdowns and protests, and it's been a crazy, tumultuous, emotional time for everyone. How have you, as one of the leaders of your company, been dealing with it? And also, how were those first couple weeks and months after you may have had to shut down locations or alter some of your business, especially in Manhattan?
I think you're right that it's been really difficult. I am lucky to count myself as somebody who is rather optimistic. And I think some of that optimism has paid off in the last couple of months, because I think one thing we've committed to is we've doubled down on our commitment to our mission. We just had to really decide to move quickly. Our restaurant, we decided not to close any of our restaurants, and just to heighten a lot of our safety and hygiene measures, but also it was important for us to come up quickly with new revenue streams to support our staff. Early on, I think the most important thing to us was a share a meal program. So our share a meal program was a program we had started initially with the New York Presbyterian and then eventually other hospitals where we were donating a lot of meals to frontline workers. The great thing about that is we were soliciting donations that were feeding frontline workers, but we were making sure that these hospitals, that these meals were being paid for, that they weren't being made for free, and that they were handed off in a hygiene and safe manner at the height of COVID in New York City, so and in New Haven. So really quickly identifying like how what we have inside of our kitchens that we might be able to use to make sure that everyone can continue to be paid, and we can do something good for the community was really important. Once COVID started dying down a little, that's when we started distance dining. And that's what I meant when I was saying that we wanted to double down and commit to our mission, which is to change the way people think about Chinese food. We wanted to keep doing it. We wanted to continue cooking creatively, sort of despite the fact that everyone's quarantined and stuck at home. So what that required was us reimagining how food is going to be distributed, and how to sort of create a product and an experience that was engaging to people. I think distance dining is how we ended up, how we settled on that, by serving people three courses, which is probably a lot more substantial than what they were cooking for themselves at home. But it was also served cold and it had to be reheated, so it was interactive. There's an Instagram live component. And on top of that, there were collaborations that we were doing sort of digitally with other chefs. We would talk about recipes, share recipes over the phone or Zoom or whatever, and then execute them in our own separate kitchens and then deliver them to our customers, which meant that they could like eat and think about the ideas that two separate chefs were coming together to put forward. So in short, I think doubling down on that optimism and that need for cooking creatively while just being agile with how food is being distributed to your customers, I think really got us through a lot of the more difficult times.
And so let's look to the future and let's look at it through a positive lens, since I'm happy to hear that you're an optimist and so am I. So let's think of a best case scenario for Junza and your team and yourself. What do you think the next 12 months, 16 months, 24 months will look like?
I don't even know what's happening next week. It's like, I think now is a more important time than ever to start addressing the kind of like American Chinese restaurant question. So I'd really like to see our operations expand on that front. Nice Day Chinese hopefully will do well and we'll get closer and closer to building a business model that we can start using to help American Chinese restaurants that are going out of business. I'd like to also, that's one. Another is I'd really like to see how something like distance dining might be able to exist in a pandemic world permanently, right? Like I personally am very worried for so many of my friends who have full service restaurants who are doing outdoor dining right now. Most of them are killing it, but outdoor dining is going to be over in the winter. And I'm worried that, and I'd be interested in seeing how a program like distance dining might have more longevity and scalability in times when people are going to retreat back into their apartments. And the last thing is and this is a constant question, is to think a little bit more deeply and see how Junza might be able in the future to assert itself as a thought leader in trying to right some of the injustices of the food system. I'm very, very cautious of the vulnerabilities of the food system, specifically climate change, but also how the people who work in food are so often unfairly treated systematically, systemically. So I think addressing those issues in a confident and consistent manner is something that I'd like to hold ourselves, is a standard that I'd like to hold ourselves to.
Lucas, thanks so much for joining me and talking about your story and Jinza, and of course, everything that may be coming in the future.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
You have 4 locations. 1 is in New Haven. 3 are in New York. If you can direct people to a website or an Instagram where they can find more information out about the brand and where they can discover all the locations to visit.
Yeah. So you can follow Jinza Kitchen at JUNZI Kitchen on Instagram and everywhere else. Our website is jinza.kitchen, JUNZI.kitchen. Check out our new Chinese American concept, our American Chinese concept, Nice Day Chinese, at eatnicedaycom. And my Instagram is at lucas.sin. There's a little bit of home cooking on there. There's a little bit of history on there. So yeah, DM me if any of you have any questions or want to chat or hang out.
And they can find information also about the distance dining on the
Kitchen website. Yep, and the Instagram.
And that program is still ongoing?
Yep.
Amazing. Lucas, sweet. Thanks again, everybody. Thank you so much for listening. And go check out Jinza if you're in New Haven or New York City.
The Line is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners just like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.